From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today, we'll talk about money.
Where's the money? When are you going to get the money? Why aren't you getting the money now?
Why we don't budget, how to teach our kids to handle it, and why students in Georgia have so much debt. Our parents and guardians are usually our first teachers, but many parents don't teach their kids about money, or bank accounts, or credit cards, or taxes. So tell us, what was the best piece of financial advice you've ever gotten? Or what is the best advice you give to others on money? Tweet your first thoughts at OSD Talk. You can also post a message on Facebook or just call us. We're at 404-500-9457, and we might feature your comment on the show. You know, more than two-thirds of Americans don't use a budget, and I don't really understand that. When you go to Best Buy and you see a new TV that you want, how do you know if you can afford it if you don't have a budget? I keep track of every penny I spend. I have to, because I don't have a lot of pennies and most of them are spoken for. But I learned about budgeting the hard way, by making disastrous financial decisions over and over until I taught myself the basics. My mother never taught me how to handle a checking account or a credit card. She never taught me the difference between compound interest and simple interest. Whenever they poll young people on what they wish they'd learned in school, basic money management ends up in the top 10. Here's a bit of LearnVest CEO and founder Alexa von Tobel speaking in her TEDx talk.
Personal finance isn't taught in high schools, colleges, or graduate programs across the United States. People typically learn about personal finance by talking to their parents, who unfortunately were also never formally educated about personal finance. The takeaway there is most people simply learn through trial and error.
I decided not to make the same mistake with my kid. I vowed I would teach him how to handle money.
Well, how much do you want to set aside this month, or this half of the month?
Let's see if we can do 300 at a time.
Okay, so every half a month, 300?
Yeah. No. Half a month, 150. Let's see if we can do 150 at every 2 weeks.
Beginning in July of this year, my son started doing all the budgeting for our household. We went back through 2 years of expenses, added up what we spent on groceries, insurance, eating out, and everything else, and created a budget that allowed us to put away a good sum into savings every month.
I want to see what you paid for $100 in tax credit for.
Okay, AT&T, $185. That's because we're paying for our phones. EMC hasn't been that much. Can we look to see how much our EMC has been for the past couple months?
97. Let's see, 132. So yeah, kind of that much.
Every week, we sit down. I read off what we've spent. He subtracts it from the amount budgeted. So we're allowed to spend $120 every month on dining out. If I pay $36 for pizza, he tells me we have $84 left.
EMC, $102. It fluctuates kind of... Well, that was $102 twice in a row. Fluctuates kind of randomly, though. $149. See, that time it even went over.
If we end the month within $50 of our budget goal, Grant gets a bonus of $25. So far, that has only happened once, but he is very motivated to see it happen again.
Grant, what? How much do we have left in tax deductions?
Zero.
Are we over?
Yes, we're over.
For the whole month or for half the month?
Half the month. What did you buy?
Something for work.
Okay. Wow, that's so specific. Thank you, Mom. I feel enlightened. What did you buy?
Well, I don't need to tell you every expenditure I make.
You're making me do the budget. I feel like I should know what you're budgeting.
You are correct.
So what am I budgeting?
Did we ever adjust the budget based on the categories that we were going over?
Yeah, but you said it needed further adjusting.
Almost immediately when we started doing this, my son became aware of how much things cost. At the grocery store, he buys the cheaper generic version of everything. At Target, he doesn't pick up extra things anymore. He's got a calculator constantly running in the back of his head, telling him we can't afford whatever that is he wants. Another important lesson? I've told him to pay money into our savings account with every paycheck just like we'd pay a bill. Since he started budgeting, we've put more than $1,000 away.
We haven't spent any money on movies. Do you want to take that out and put it into miscellaneous?
I guess. Okay, so movies doesn't exist. Movies don't exist anymore. There's no such thing as movies, Mom. What's a movie?
This summer, I was struck by a fact in the Washington Post. Almost half of Americans could not pay for an unexpected expense of $400 without borrowing money. That is a scary situation. and it's the kind of situation that careful budgeting might prevent. Look, parenting is not easy, and I'm sure I've made enough mistakes to supply plenty of material for my son's therapist someday. But in one way at least, he will be ahead of where I was as a 20-year-old. He'll know how to manage his money. Let me paraphrase Charles Dickens' famous quote from David Copperfield. Annual income, $400. Annual expenditure, $399.99. Result, happiness. Annual income, $400. Annual expenditure, $401. Result, misery. Translation, spend less than you earn. And hopefully, my son will know both how much he earns and how much he can spend.
Excuse you. Those are essentials.
We don't include comic books and HeroClix figures in essentials.
But they are essential.
But they are not.
But
essentials is like vaccinations for the dog.
Yeah, that's basically as essential as vaccinations.
When it comes to money matters, sometimes it is best to call in an expert opinion, so let's do that now. Sherilyn Narker is an economic and financial education specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, and she joins us this morning. Hi.
Hi, good morning. It's good to be here.
Any ideas on why we don't teach our kids about, I'm not even talking about complicated things like buying a house or playing the stock market. I'm talking about the fact that many kids leave college and say they wish they'd known how to handle a checking account and the difference between one credit card and another. Why don't we teach our kids that?
Well, particularly in Georgia, we are teaching it. We have it in our standards K through eighth grade and our high school economics course. I think where we break down is that we don't practice what we're learning. And from everything that I've read, the research, one of the most important things for successful financial management as an adult is that you have developed those behaviors over a long period of time. And so if your academic knowledge is not being practiced in a day-to-day format, chances are you're not going to put it into practice in your day-to-day life as an adult. And I think the schools can teach the idea of credit and why it's important to have it and how to keep a budget. But unless at home parents are reinforcing that by having their children keep a budget every month and see their income coming in and their expenses going out, children are not really going to put it into their own lives.
If a parent doesn't have a budget, and as I mentioned, more than two-thirds of Americans do not budget. So if the parents don't know how to do that, how are they going to teach their kids?
It is a very difficult dilemma for parents. One, some parents who just are not aware of these financial tools. Some who maybe because their own finances are not what they would like to see are really...
Well, I think that's most of us.
They're just terrified to share that information with their kids. They don't want them to worry. They don't want them to feel unstable. Maybe even if you're not talking about budgeting with your kids and doing actual financial work with them, maybe one way to help them with their financial picture in the future is to teach them delayed gratification early on.
The benefits of.
Exactly.
Here's the thing that I think may keep many people from dealing with money at all. A, it is a very emotionally fraught topic because
absolutely
most of us do not have extra money. That's just the way that it is, except for the 1%. That brings up for a lot of people feelings of shame and stress. But the other thing for me is that I think when people hear, you know, you'll hear ads for banks talking about wealth management, and I don't have any wealth, and so I say, well, that ad is meant for somebody else. Even if your income is very, very low, it doesn't matter what your income is. If you have income, you can budget. So how do you get past that, those feelings of shame and stress and anger and frustration to get someone to actually figure out how much they're earning and then how much they can spend?
There just comes a time when you have to face yourself. One of the things that many financial experts recommend, the first step is just to write down everything that you spend. Just daily, keep a log, see where the money is going, And that can often show you all the little things that over a month's time add up. And that might be a good place to start, but it's very hard to take
that
first step.
That's so fascinating because often, often weight loss counselors will say write down everything that you eat because you may not realize that those cookies you keep grabbing off your coworker's desk add up to 1,200 calories over the day.
Exactly.
And
right.
It may be that you don't realize that every time you go to Starbucks and pick up a Danish and a coffee, how much that adds up to over the course of a month.
That is so true. And that's why those two things are very, very difficult, but they're also incredibly rewarding once we're willing to face it and move forward with a plan of some sort. Starting the long-term versus short-term savings from work performed at whatever level the kid can do. Having them look at the growth.
You mean giving
them
money for doing chores around the house.
Exactly.
So that they have money to control.
Yes.
So if you're at the zoo and they want an ice cream, you say, that's not in my budget. Do you have some cash left?
Right. And so something as simple as contributing part of the cost of a friend's birthday present rather than the parent going out and buying the whole thing for them. Looking if it's possible to set up some sort of account for them where they're earning more than, say, just a savings account. You know, it may or may not be possible, but letting them look at the interest that they're earning over time so they're like, oh, I get money from working, but I can also get income from letting my money work for me. And I think that that's where many of the people who are able to build wealth in our society, what they've learned is that power of passive income.
Who taught you about, how did you learn about basic money management?
Well, I learned some from my parents, but a lot has happened as I've gone through my own adult life and discovered a passion for economics and the economic way of thinking, being able to apply decision-making matrix and cost-benefit analysis, which I actually do with my children when they're making big decisions or big purchases. So it has been a lifetime of learning, and there are many things. I've got a 18-year-old son who just went off to UGA, and just to give you an example, even with all the knowledge that I have in this area, one thing that completely surprised me when he went off to college is, one, the cost of joining a fraternity, and then the fraternities at UGA, or at least his, they turn over the management of collecting their dues to an outside third-party company. And I had no idea to warn him about that. Yes. And so there are always new things to become aware of, even when you've been in this sphere for quite some time.
An employee of the Federal Reserve Bank got unexpected bills, so that makes me feel better about when I get them. I learned about budgeting through trial and error. I'm certainly interested in how many of you also were taught what you were taught by your parents and what you had to learn by making mistakes. Let us know. And also tips for how you teach your own teenagers or nieces and nephews or grandchildren. Tweet them to us at OST Talk or call and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Sherilyn Narker is an economic and financial education specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Sherilyn, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up, why did Georgia students owe so much, and how can we help them climb out of the student debt hole? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about money today, and students in Georgia owe a lot of it. The highest average amount of student debt of any state in the nation. It's such a big problem that President Obama came to Georgia Tech in 2015 to talk about it.
But even here at Georgia Tech, even with the great value it is, it's expensive. And I'm here to tell you, I'm with you. I believe that America's not a place where higher education is a privilege that is reserved for the few. America needs to be a place where higher education has to be available for every single person who's willing to strive for it, who's willing to work for it.
Georgia leads the country on average federal student debt, and we're second in average debt per borrower. That means about 1.5 million of us in this state are carrying somewhere around $30,000 in debt each. And having high debt numbers isn't just a challenge for the people who owe that debt. It can also affect the state's education and economy as well. We're going to dig into this issue and talk about the real costs of student debt. But we want to know what you think or get your personal stories about how you paid for college. Maybe you're paying for it right now. Tweet us at OST Talk to weigh in on this conversation. You can also comment on our Facebook page or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. So let's start today's discussion with the student borrower experience. Stanley Lewis Jr. is a recent graduate from Georgia Tech. He left school with that one of those coveted engineering degrees and about $100,000 in student debt, all of it in federal loans. Stanley, welcome to On Second Thought.
Welcome. Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming in. So help me understand what kind of financial advice you got when you went to school and took out your first loan. Who talked to you?
I actually got no advice. I went to Georgia Southern University first, and all I was told was to register for these classes, and this is how much it would cost. My mom and my dad, we sat down and we discussed how we would pay for it. I gave them the reassurance that if I took out student loans, I would pay them back. They would not be responsible for them. But that's the only option I had to pay at the time, and the very, very sudden date that they gave me between July and September 15th to pay my first semester of college off.
So I remember from college sitting down in the student aid office or whatever they call it at the campus and having a sign, go fill out your FAFSA and sign all those papers. Did anybody at that point when you were signing for these things give you advice or tell you any details about what you were doing?
The only advice that I did receive was a high school teacher of mine. She told me to make sure that I was ready for college and that this would be an investment into my future. She told me that make sure that the job that you are applying for, that you are looking for, will be able to afford the debt that you will be taking out in college. No one at Georgia Southern actually helped me with financial aid. They told me that I would just have to pay it back. Don't take out more than you need. But that was the extent of my knowledge on student loans when I was 17.
What about when you went to Georgia Tech? Did you get better advice there?
Actually, because being that I transferred to Georgia Tech, they don't give the transfers amount of help that they do freshmen. So they assumed that I knew everything and I wouldn't need any help with my student loans or anything of that nature.
Did you work while you were in college?
Yes, I worked about 25 hours a week, Subway, when I was first down in Georgia Southern. And they actually paid for my food. So my Georgia Southern years, my first 2 years of college, I didn't use much money on food, but I had to pay for the dorms and living 4 hours away from my family. So I had to pay for those things going back and forth.
Yeah, okay. Let me just say here quickly, because I want everyone to have an understanding of the average. So the College Board collects data on how much things cost. The average cost of going to a state resident, an in-state resident at a public college is somewhere around between $9,000 and $10,000. But then you have to include room and board. Room and board for the average college student is about $10,000 a year. Each of these is a yearly cost. And then the average cost for books and supplies is somewhere around $1,100. And other expenses, all the other things you need for living expenses, are somewhere around, for public universities, $3,200 or more. So that comes out to somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000 a year for your average college student. And I should mention that costs vary widely from one university to the other. That's just the national average. So now that Stanley, you've gotten out of school, have you started repaying yet?
Yes.
And can I ask how much your monthly payment is?
My original monthly payment total, I say total because I have a personal student loan debt, which is around $30,000. And I have my mother's, she did me a favor and took out around $60,000 to $70,000 because they maximized mine. And our total payment was around $1,500 a month.
Holy cow. I assume they brought that down as income sensitive?
No. We just applied for income sensitive maybe a few months ago, so it's on deferment as of right now while they process our actual need. We're trying to get it down to around $600 a month.
So, I mean, one of the things that you were talking about earlier was trying to find a job that would allow you to pay back your student loans. Does that mean you have to turn down jobs that don't pay? I mean...
Definitely. I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a teacher for the engineering students in high school. But, obviously, they don't pay me enough to, outside of my basic living needs, to pay $1,500 worth of debt. So I had to reevaluate that and go into the private engineering sector. So that's what I'm doing right now.
All right. Stanley is with us throughout this hour. We're going to come back and maybe even get you some financial advice on this show. So you're going to stick around, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So let's talk about how having a high debt load is costing not just people like Stanley, but the entire state of Georgia. Joining me now is Thomas Smith. He's an assistant professor in the practice of finance at Emory University. Welcome back.
Hey, welcome. Thank you very much.
And also with us is Latasha Kennard, a personal finance coach and founder of Start Young Financial Group. It's good to have you again as well, Latasha.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So first of all, Latasha, is Stanley's story average? Is that a normal, common story?
It is extremely average, unfortunately. I work with several young adults, and this is what they tell me, Celeste. And the truth of the matter is that when I'm sitting with young adults, it is not uncommon for them to be across the table from me in tears because of their student loan debt. This is something that is burdening them so much. And one young lady told me yesterday that student loan debt is a larger burden than her mortgage and car note and all other debt combined, which
Holy
I think
cow.
Is a true testament to how much this is becoming a burden and an issue for the not only the young adults, but for the people of our nation overall.
And Tom, this is also, I mean, you heard him say he would have been a teacher, but he can't afford to be a teacher.
Sure.
I mean, that's for the state of Georgia. That's a major loss if that's a normal story.
So, you know, whenever we engage in, you know, an investment, like education is an investment, then the truth is that sometimes you have to think forward and say, what are the choices that I have to make so that I can make this investment work, right? And so the truth is that we can't all take on jobs that may have large sort of ancillary benefits, sort of non-monetary benefits, and that is a shame.
So let's talk a little bit about how the ELTS that impacts
the
state of Georgia, because there's a trickle-down effect. In his particular case, his mother co-signed his loans. How does all these things affect us economically, or even our structure?
So, I mean, whenever you take on debt, I mean, what you're doing is you're obviously making a promise to pay in the future for, monies that you're going to receive for an investment of some sort now. And the truth is that, you know, these things carry interest. You're going to have to pay more than what you're borrowing in the first place. I mean, federal debt has some pretty low interest rates, all things considered. But what happens is, you know, if his mother takes on some of his debt, and then she's not going to be able to buy other things in the future, right? I mean, the more debt that we carry, the less other kind of consumables we're going to have at some point. And, you know, in a state like Georgia, where we have high unemployment as well,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that creates another issue where how do I pay this back? What happens if I end up being unemployed? I mean, there's multiple issues that are at stake here, not just the fact that we have the debt, but we have the debt in a system. Like, our economy has other kind of issues.
Stanley, I wonder how concerned you are that this could affect your credit rating overall, since, you know, obviously debt is a huge factor in that, whether that means it would affect your ability to own a house or further down the line, any of the big purchases you'd have to make.
It really does. I am looking to own a home as soon as possible, but I can't make the commitment with this, my student loan amount monthly not being solidified and certain for me. I don't want to take on a mortgage that will combine with my student loan debt to be more than my income every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So it actually limits my options a lot.
Latasha, can we talk just about the details of student loans? Because student loans represent a very unique type of debt. They come with their own set of rules, their own set of interest rates. We're talking about federals having a pretty low interest rate, and I understand if you're borrowing now, they are. But for example, my student loans, I came out of school with an 8% interest rate, and I can't change it. I can't discharge it in bankruptcy, nothing. Can you explain how a student loan is different than, say, a mortgage?
Sure. A student loan is very different because, first of all, there is no type of recourse to get rid of it. Once you have it, it is yours. So get used to it because it's sticking around. Outside of that, it can be very difficult to consolidate those loans. So if you have different types of loans from different areas or federal versus other types of loans, it can be very difficult to consolidate them. And I think those are the two main things that I try to make sure my clients understand is that once you get it, it's not going away. Make sure that this is something that you're willing to stick with for the long run. And even though the interest rates tend to be low today, the principal is larger. So we're taking out, millennials right now are taking out more student loan debt than the generations that came before us. So our low interest rate is awesome. However, it's still going to wind up being a lot of interest because of the high principal debt that we have.
Why are the student loans this different? Either you or Tom can answer this. How did it come to be that student loans became this very different thing than a car loan or a house loan or any other kind of loan you get?
You know, one thing I tell my clients is that you should think about how long you want to pay back a student loan. So when you take out a car, you have a very clear idea of how long you want to pay this back. When you get a mortgage, you have an idea of how long you're going to pay back that mortgage. But when you take out a student loan, a lot of times most people are not thinking about how long this is going to cost them, how long they're going to have to pay this overall. So I don't know why it's so different. So I'm going to defer to Tom on this.
There's a lobbying mechanism. I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there's lobbying going on.
Okay.
Right? Let's change these laws. Because what we're talking about in the end are laws that determine what can be dischargeable in bankruptcy and what cannot. So how come I can get rid of my mortgage in bankruptcy and not a student loan?
Yeah, so my understanding is that you know, when these laws establishing the loans were put in place is that the people who had an interest, that is, people who were making the individual loans, like private loans, right?
Right.
They wanted to make sure that the people who were taking out these loans actually had some skin in the game. And that is, so if you could go forward and say, look, I'm going to take out $100,000 as our colleague here has taken out. And you know what, in like 4 or 5 years, what I'm going to do is I'm going to file for bankruptcy. This makes the lending institutions incredibly weary about putting this out there in the first place. Because unlike other loans where you have some kind of collateral, there's no collateral in these loans.
They're unsecured.
The collateral is that you're going to get an education, and the education is going to make you more productive. And as a result, you're going to have a higher earnings potential and a higher, you know, earnings trajectory over the course of your life. And so if I'm the lender, I'm thinking, look, I'm making a risk, it's a gamble, right? The gamble is I'm going to give you $20,000, $30,000, $70,000, and what I'm doing is I'm gambling on your ability to be a more productive citizen, right? And it's so there's nothing tangible that I can possess if you default. And so I can't sell off your soul. I mean, in some respects, maybe that's what's going on.
Stanley, you obviously have a lot of struggle, obstacles in your future. We have a group of incredibly smart, well-informed people gathered around you. What question would you like to ask?
I would like to ask Mr. Smith about what options you think I should take to not only pay back my loans, but also strive to be the American that everyone wants us to be, to save money, to be able to invest my money, and to be able to have a great financial structure for my family when I've turned 30 years old, when I'm ready to have children and have a wife and have a home.
So, now you have the debt, right? And the way that I think of this, and I worked in financial fitness and financial education for, 8 years in Chicago doing workshops of this nature. And the truth is, now that you have the debt and you can't do anything about that debt, what you have to do is you have to actually probably make some hard choices about where you're going to spend money right now, and also try to find jobs that can propel you into a little bit larger income bracket, right? And so the kind of things that I would encourage people to do is take on a roommate first couple of years right out of college, right? Don't you know, when you first get your job, don't go for a new car, like, you know, buy an old Honda Civic, right? I mean, buy something that's going to get you back and forth, right? So, you know, do some shopping at your local Aldi and things of this nature. I mean, it sounds like it's just a fix. It's a Band-Aid. But the truth is that if you can't change how much debt you've taken out, which is you can't at this point, what you have to do is cut back on your spending and then try to boost your income as much as possible. And the spending areas where you can cut back on are housing and living expenses and transportation. And these are kind of things that can make a big difference right away for paying back some of this stuff.
That was a conversation I had back in 2015. You heard the voices of Georgia Tech alum Stanley Lewis, Emory University economist Tom Smith, and financial coach Latasha Kennard of Start Young Financial. Coming up, only two states have a minimum wage below the federal rate. One is Wyoming. Guess what the other one is? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. The minimum wage will most likely be up for discussion again this year. Georgia is one of only two states with a minimum wage below the federal rate of $7.25 an hour. Our rate is $5.15 an hour. A proposed bill in 2015 would have raised that to $10 and change, but it failed in the state house. While that debate was happening, though, we talked to two experts about the state's minimum wage and why it is so low. Tom Smith is assistant professor at Emory University, and Sasha Tumich is an associate professor of economics at Mercer University. We spoke to them both in 2015. So let's first deal with some supporters who say that this claim that it would save the state money. And I want to quote Harold Jones here, who's a state senator. He says, "What we find is raising the minimum wage actually brings people off government programs. We expect it to save $130 million in Georgia because we're going to remove people from the government role." Tom, what do we know about what effect minimum wage has on people applying for state benefits?
Well, I mean, there's some mixed evidence that it either brings people off of the welfare rolls, as this other person suggested. There's more evidence that increases productivity and that increases the bottom line for companies. I mean, saving the money from the state is one thing, but increasing profitability for companies, I think that's what people are really interested in.
And yet, Sasha, we got a report from the Congressional Budget Office when President Obama first proposed raising the minimum wage. That was mixed. In some cases, it said it could result in the loss of about 500,000 jobs. And on the other hand, it said it would raise people out of poverty level. What's the truth here?
Well, the truth, Celeste, is, as usual, somewhere in between. And it's not that easy to say without any qualification. And when I'd like to say again, when we talk about raising minimum wage, the big question is, how close is the minimum wage to the wage that would otherwise be negotiated? And if it's close, the effects are small, and if people keep jobs, then they will be out of the poverty. So the argument that's being made is right now somebody makes about $15,000 a year if they are working full-time minimum wage, and if we increase it to $10,000, they will make roughly $20,000 a year, so they will be raised out of poverty. But that is a false choice because the person might lose their job, and actually we could see an increase in the outlays to help people who have lost jobs or had hours cut because of the minimum wage increase. So it is not the same answer if we are talking about $10 per hour in New York or Washington, D.C., or Washington State versus $10 per hour in Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama or Tennessee.
Well, I should say that there's in this bill that's been proposed to raise the minimum wage in Georgia, there are a number of exceptions, including small businesses, employers that have five employees or less that have sales of $40,000 a year or less. It also wouldn't include high school or college students, people who get their money from tips. Waitresses would be excluded, mm-hmm. I guess. But what do we know, Tom, about the effect in other states that the minimum wage has had? I mean, in some ways, this is kind of an economist's dream, right? Because you can look at the reality of what's occurred when other states have raised the minimum wage.
Yeah, but I mean, so Sasha is correct in that, you know, there's some natural experiments out there. We can look at what happens in California. We can look at what happens in some other states. The truth is that each of these economies have their own ebb and flow, their own characteristics, if you will. What we've seen in California is that, you know, having a wage that's much above the minimum wage and having other types of laws that enforce overtime, mandatory overtime after 8 hours in a single day rather than 40 hours over a week, haven't significantly impacted the unemployment in a negative way. And so we see that different states come up with rules that make sense for their labor pools. And I think that $10 an hour in Georgia makes sense, but it's not something you can just universally say it's always going to be this way.
Well, let's then talk about whether companies can afford it, shall we? Because I think that especially when we look at large companies, places like Walmart and McDonald's, and they've been targeted by efforts to raise minimum wages, and you see some of their profits. Walmart's worldwide revenue is somewhere in $425 billion or so. People wonder why fight it. If you're making those kind of profits, what difference does it make whether you if you raise the minimum wage by a few dollars? Sasha, what leads companies of that size to resist so strongly?
Well, basically, if you look, you know, you mentioned Walmart's revenue, but the real question are Walmart's profit. So you can see that Google, I believe, has turned more profit on a much less revenue than Walmart did. So Walmart is working with the very thin margins. So what Walmart wants to do is provide low prices and provide nice experience for its customers. And that gets difficult to do when you raise minimum wage. So one answer that they might have to that is obviously pass the cost increases to the consumers, and that is the last thing that any business wants to do. So what they will most likely do first is reduce the number of people. And we have examples in retail industry, like Costco is a famous example that pays much more than Walmart. But if you look very closely, you will find that Costco hires about half as many people per square foot of store than Walmart does. And that's what enables them to pay higher wages. And that's why the Costco workers are more productive. So what Walmart might do in this sense, that they are fighting minimum wage increase simply because it's another cost increase for them. But this is the effect that it might have, and it is, you know, we will see fewer people employed in Walmart for fewer hours. And if the situation is bad enough, if the increase is high enough, then we might even see Walmart not be open 24 hours, like we've seen some grocery stores that used to have all of the stores open 24 hours. Now they might have 2 out of 5. So those are the reasons that they are stepping in. It's a cost increase for them, and it's something that any businesses do not like seeing cost increases, because if they cannot deliver profits, their investors, and by that I mean you and I and anybody with a retirement plan, in addition to the your standard rich cigar smoking investors, we will pull our money and put it somewhere where it can bring us more return so that we can have more comfortable retirement. And that's what Walmart is fighting against.
So Sasha, let's take on one other argument in this discussion, because it is complicated, and that is that the minimum wage is expected to be a starting wage and not a livable wage. How true is that?
Again, it depends. In major markets like, say, Atlanta, it's probably very true. And to Tom's point, he also made a lot of great points, which is workers will be more productive when they are paid more and so on. But that's why companies really do not want to pay minimum wage to people for a long time. That is not good business. That's not how you keep your productive workers. So the idea of paying workers more and they will be more productive only works if you pay them more relative to what somebody else pays. So if you raise minimum wage for everybody, that is not going to make anybody more productive, except for the fact that workers are more productive when there are fewer of them.
Well, but then,
and this, which is what motivates some of this discussion. And I do want to just throw out one more idea here, not idea, but an issue here. We also, it's a very different discussion if we raise minimum wage nationally to 10-10, or if Georgia does it on their own, especially considering that no state with whom we compete for new jobs or the new projects, as the economic developers call them, we mostly compete with states in our neighborhood, which would be Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, to some degree Florida. Of all of these states, only Florida has the higher minimum wage than the federal minimum, and they do have lower unemployment, but they also have a much lower labor force participation rate than Georgia does, which means they have a lot of retired people. So the problem that you have is, and so this is actually really important, because the issue is not the level of minimum wage, but where are you compared to everybody else? And that's the same story with paying people more than minimum wage. You want to pay better than your competition, so you get the first pick of people that work for you. You get the best and the brightest and most productive, which is why the law firms in Atlanta obsess over who pays what to first-year associates, because nobody wants to be the bargain basement employer. But when we raise it for everybody, that effect is gone, and the only productivity then to look for in people who work for minimum wage has to come from having fewer of them work.
Right. That is Sasha Tumich. He is an associate professor of economics at Mercer University. We also spoke with Tom Smith, assistant professor at Emory University's Goizueta Business School. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, Celeste.
A local high school teacher used the debate over the minimum wage to teach his students a lesson in empathy. And we talked about it as part of our series on unusual classes called Lessons from Left Field. Stephen Giraj teaches religious studies at Holy Innocents Episcopal School, and his class looked into the ethics of the minimum wage debate. He embarked on a week-long project to live off minimum wage and had his students set his budget. What did they learn? It is not easy.
We started thinking about, okay, well, what happens when you have to get like an extra winter coat for when it rains, or what happens when you get sick? Just there were so many little things that we were forgetting and just had to keep adding on and on. And at one point, we had like been so off for the budget that we had left him with like $10 for a month.
The minimum wage in Georgia is currently $5.25 an hour. That's $2 less than the federal standard. And to be clear, nobody's paid $5.25. You have to pay your workers the higher wage, whatever it is. For our occasional series on unusual class courses, we're going to talk to Stephen Giraj about his class. With him is his student Chase Rainbow and Haven Boaz. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's talk first about teaching ethics by making a budget. Why this particular method?
I wanted to make it as real as possible for the students.
And you now they only had to make a budget for you for a week?
Yes.
Okay, which is, you know, kind of unreal. I mean, you're not going to, you know, move out of your house and not get a car anymore, right? I mean,
no, but to make it more real, I did either walk to school, which was 3.5 miles, or walk home. I took away my debit and credit cards as well.
Wow. Okay. So, Chase, you were part of the class making a budget for him?
Yes, I was.
So tell me about how you approached that. Tell me some of the categories you had to fit into his weekly budget.
Well, we thought about basic needs, things that he has to have to survive. So we thought food, shelter. So we picked some of the cheapest foods we could find, ramen noodles, you know, hitting the dollar menu at McDonald's a little bit, and just things like that. And then for shelter, we had them pay. We kind of looked up like the average rent of a smaller house, and that's what we had them rent. And then, that's kind of how we were picking out basic needs.
Haven, what was his weekly, what was the amount he could spend per week?
Oh, gosh. I think it came to about.
Chase is like, you can just say, Chase, you don't have to give
about,
him sign language.
$320,
which to the average high school student sounds like a lot of money, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
But did you make it work? Could he afford everything?
Kind of. I mean, not the things that he like really wanted. I know one thing that he would talk about often in class was having to switch his yogurt brand because he couldn't afford getting mass amounts of his preferred brand. So it's really compromise trying to live off of that. I mean, it's possible, but you give up a lot of things that you enjoy.
Well, let's take a listen. This is Will Epperson, another one of Stephen's students, talking about the importance of empathy in this debate.
You can talk about theory, for you can talk about, well, if we didn't increase minimum wage, this would happen. It's all on a whiteboard in a conference room. You know, it's not real people. But if you actually go out and see the people that live on minimum wage, or you see the people that go through any challenge on a day-to-day basis, I think you're going to be hard-pressed not to want to help those people.
Stephen, I wondered if you were prepared maybe from complaints from parents. And there were, not aware of complaints from parents. This is coming completely out of my mind. But, I mean, anytime you bring up a subject in schools that's part of a current political debate, it seems like there's pushback that the teacher is pressing an agenda, right?
There usually is. I believe there were some national radio people that were against it. But the Holy Innocence community has been very supportive. Pre-K teachers, parents have been very supportive as well. This class, both my ethics classes, have been really good being compassionate towards each other, whether in an abortion debate, other debates as well that we've done this year. So I felt that they were ready for this.
And Chase, this was part of your context came from your parents and their business, right? Tell me about what they do.
My father's he's the owner of Rainbow Landscapes, and he's a landscaper, and he also is a pool builder. And you know, I came home one day after learning about this, and I was like, well, I mean, we should raise a minimum wage. And my mom's like, well, I mean, they should. But, you know, if your father has to pay his workers more money to do the same job, someone's going to have to get let go. And that means that the people that are left are going to have to pull the slack for that individual that had to be let go, because he can just not simply start paying everybody a lot more an hour to do the same job.
And I wonder, Haven, if you came down with a real answer, Did the class decide, yes, minimum wage needs to be raised, or no, it doesn't?
No, and I don't think that our class will actually be able to come down to a yes or a no answer, just because there are so many aspects to think about. Because, again, what Chase was saying is, even if we raise a minimum wage, someone's going to get let go. And we were actually talking, my group for our minimum wage project, talked to Amy Muir. And she is very well up to date on the economy. And she drew us a chart showing us the supply and demand and what would happen if the minimum wage was raised. And it basically concluded that raising the minimum wage might result in more unemployment than now. And at my group personally decided that we would rather have people with jobs that maybe aren't paying as much over not having jobs at all and just living out on the streets.
How about for yourself? Would you want to be living off a minimum wage job?
I would rather that than no job at all.
What about you?
Yeah, I believe that you should be at least making money. If you bring in any income, it's better than none.
So what context does it give you when you then now go back to ask your parents for something expensive? When you say, Mom, I want that $600 iPhone, do you think about it differently?
Yeah, we do think about it differently. Because, you know, before we know things cost money, but we never knew how much money things actually cost and how valuable money can actually be for someone that doesn't have that much. So it does make us sit back and think about it before we ask something like that.
Okay, we have been speaking with Stephen J. Raj. He's a religious studies teacher at Holy Innocence Episcopal School, private school.
Yes, it is.
So I'm not sure this can be replicated in public schools, but who knows? Also, high school junior Chase Rainbow and Haven Boaz. You're also a junior, Haven?
I am, yes.
Okay, thank you all for coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
And that's our show for today, but we still want to hear your tips on handling money. What's the best financial advice you've ever gotten? Or what advice do you give on dealing with money? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can post on Facebook or just tweet us. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.